Okay, so this is Energy Carl. Paul is here. Excellent. Welcome to Paul. This is educational on the Revolution Betrayed, Chapter 7, Part 2. And the chapter is titled Family, Youth and Culture. And we dealt extensively with the woman question aspect of this 3 weeks ago, I think. This is a shorter section on titled The Struggle Against the Youth. So I'll just go through that. I'm not going to talk for too long because it's not a very long section, though it does contain some quite important material. But anyway, this part follows on from the previous section on the bureaucracy and women's oppression and criticizes the same moralistic and paternalistic attitude that the Thermidorian regime, as we defined it earlier, displayed towards women, and this time towards the youth. And I think there's a warning for us in this analysis, though it's sort of tangential to the subject matter of the article itself. But nevertheless, although we're in a different situation, completely different to that that's narrated here, Trotsky writes this. He says that every revolutionary party finds its chief support in the younger generation of the rising class. Political decay expresses itself in a loss of ability to attract the youth under one's banner. The parties of bourgeois democracy, in withdrawing one after another from the scene, are compelled to turn over the young to either revolution or fascism. Bolshevism went underground, was always a party of young workers. The Mensheviks relied upon the more respectable, skilled upper stratum of the working class, always prided themselves on it and looked down upon the Bolsheviks. Subsequent events harshly showed them their mistake. At the decisive moment, the youth carried with them the more mature stratum and even the old folks. And I think that's actually quite cautionary for us. It should be said and noted that this was written in a period shortly after, in comparative terms, the greatest revolution in history. And we're actually quite a small trend, an aging trend in many ways, as indeed is the Marxist left in the imperialist countries. And not necessarily just there, but particularly there. And we're the products of a missing generation on the left. And that generation is missing above all because of the huge defeats that the working class has experienced in our lifetimes. You know, defeat to the working class in Britain and the US. In the domestic class struggle, and defeat represented above all internationally by the destruction of the USSR. And we're now in a period where there's a new generation of youth being radicalized, not least by the impact of this genocide and the huge exposure of imperialism by it, and by the huge damage that's being done to the biosphere, but also by decaying capitalism. And we have to find a road to win over a younger cadre to the kind of Marxist politics that we espouse. And there's no real alternative to doing that for our movement to go forward. And I think that's just a note that I would sound on this. But just to go on the back to the subject matter of the educational, this is about the historical development of the Stalinist regime in the USSR and its relationship with the younger generation of a Russian and or other Soviet population that have even been either been radicalized or born in the aftermath of the first successful workers' revolution in history. And as Trotsky pointed out, he says that the revolution gave a mighty historical impulse to the new Soviet generation. It cut them free at one blow from conservative forms of life and exposed to them the great secret, the first secret of the dialectic, that there is nothing unchanging on this earth, and that society is made of plastic materials. How stupid is the theory of unchanging racial types in the light of the events of our epoch? The Soviet Union is an immense melting pot in which the characters of dozens of nationalities are being mixed. The mysticism of the so-called Slavic soul is coming off by like scum. And yet, the essence of the issue was that the Thermidorian regime instinctively feared the youth. And there were several millions of young workers who should have been replenishing the mass base of the Communist Party, and hundreds of thousands of communist youth who the regime mobilized for constructive work, often in the most difficult and inhospitable places, such as Trotsky says, the Arctic, Sakhalin, or in Amur, which is actually near the Chinese border, where the new town of Komsomolsk is in the process of construction. And of course, in Russian, Komsomol is the name of the Communist Youth League. So the town was called Komsomolsk, which was symbolic of something. And Trotsky points out the role of young workers in the regime's campaigns, in shock brigades, in Stakhanovism, and their studious and self-sacrificing exploits. And he cites Engels and Lenin on how it ought to be developing. He says, not conceiving of the development of a socialist society without the dying away of the state, that is, without the replacements of all kinds of police oppression by the self-administration of educated producers and consumers. Engels laid the accomplishment of this task upon the younger generation. He said, who will grow up in new free social conditions and will be in a position to cast away all this rubbish of statism. And Lenin adds on his part, he says, every kind of statism, the democratic republican included. The prospect of construction of a socialist society stood then in the mind of Engels and Lenin approximately thus. The generation that's conquered the power, the old guard, will begin the work of liquidating the state. The next generation will complete it. But that seems to have been exactly what the Thermidorian regime feared. He points out that nearly half of the population, 46% of the population of the USSR by 1936, when he was writing, was born after the October Revolution. And more than half of the population can only remember the Soviet regime. And yet, this population, far from being encouraged, was being repressed. So Trotsky says, but it is just this new generation which is forming itself, not in free social conditions as Engels conceived it, but under intolerable and constantly increasing oppression from the ruling stratum, composed of those same ones who, according to the official fiction, achieved the Great Revolution. The chief glory of man is declared to be personal loyalty to the leader and unconditional obedience. And he goes on, says, the school and the social life of the student are saturated with formalism and hypocrisy. The children have learned to sit through innumerable deadly dull meetings with their inevitable honorary presidium, their chants in honor of the dear leaders, their pre-digested righteous debates in which, quite in the manner of their elders, they say one thing and think another. And he complains about the repression of any youth who express their own ideas. He says, the most innocent groups of school children who try to create oases in this desert of officiousness are met with fierce measures of repression. Through its agentry, the GPU introduces the sickening corruption of treachery and tale-bearing into the so-called socialist schools. The more thoughtful teachers and children's writers, in spite of the enforced optimism, cannot always conceal their horror in the presence of this spirit of repression, falsity, and boredom, which is killing school life. To every word of criticism, the bureaucracy answers with a twist of the neck. All who are outstanding and unsubmissive in the ranks of the youth are systematically destroyed, suppressed, or physically exterminated. This explains the fact that out of the millions and upon millions of communist youth, there has not emerged a single big figure. So he says, well, the youth are throwing themselves into engineering, science, literature, sport, etc., with great enthusiasm. But then he says, but every contact with politics, they burn their fingers. And they basically have three choices: to become careerists in the bureaucracy, to submit and confine themselves to personal and professional life, or to go underground and learn to struggle for the future. And He says that many sought personal advancement, but the possibilities were only open to a limited layer because of the material deprivation we've talked about. And yet opportunities did exist. He goes on, he says, the restoration of market relations opens an indubitable opportunity for a considerable rise of personal prosperity. The broad trend of the Soviet youth towards the engineering profession is explained not so much by the allurements of socialist construction as by the fact that engineers earn incomparably more than physicians or teachers. When such tendencies arise in circumstances of intellectual oppression and ideological reaction, and with a conscious unleashing from above of careerist instincts, then the propagation of what is called socialist culture often turns out to be education in the spirit of the most extreme anti-social egotism. And yet he says that this should not be seen in a one-sided manner. So he goes on, he says, it would be a crude slander against the youth to portray them as controlled exclusively or even predominantly by personal interests. No, in the general mass, they are magnanimous, responsive, enterprising. Careerism colours them only from above. In their depths are formed a various unformulated tendencies grounded in heroism, which are still only awaiting application. It is upon these moves in particular that the newest kind of Soviet patriotism is nourishing itself. It is undoubtedly very deep, sincere, and dynamic. But in this patriotism, too, there is a rift which separates the young from the old. So, as he says, on the contrary, he says that the expulsion from the communist youth and the party, the arrest and exile of hundreds of thousands of young white guards, he puts it in quotes, and opportunists in quotes, on the one hand, and Bolshevik Leninists on the other, proves that the wellsprings of conscious political opposition, both left and right, are not exhausted. The more impatient, hot-blooded, unbalanced, injured in their feelings and interests, are turning in their thoughts in the direction of terrorist revenge. Such approximately is the spectrum of the political moods of the Soviet youth. And Trotsky talks about the various episodes that happened of the involvement of elements of the youth in terrorism as a symptom of the discontent of the youth. And he says that the terrorists of the latest draft are recruited exclusively from among the young, from the ranks of the communist youth and the party, not infrequently from the offspring of the ruling stratum. Although completely impotent to solve the problems which it sets itself, this individual terror has nevertheless an extremely important symptomatic significance. It characterizes the sharp contradiction between the bureaucracy and the broad masses of the people, especially the young. And the bureaucracy understands this, and it's actually fearful of the youth. And as he says again, it says, from whatever side the attack came against the position of the ruling stratum, from left or right, the attackers would recruit their chief forces among the oppressed and discontented youth deprived of political rights. The bureaucracy admirably understands this. It is in general exquisitely sensitive to everything which threatens its dominant position. Naturally, in trying to consolidate its position in advance, it erects the chief trenches and concrete fortifications against the younger generation. Thus we see the attack on the rights of the communist youth in particular, what Trotsky actually called the political expropriation of the youth, mirrored the political expropriation of the working class itself. So, as he notes, he says, well, quoting again, he says, the General Secretary of the Communist Youth, under orders from above, declared in his speech, quotes again, he's Trotsky quoting this guy, he says, we must end the chatter about industrial and financial planning, about the lowering of production costs, economic accounting, crop sowing, and other important state problems as though we were going to decide them. The whole country might as well repeat those words, as though we were going to decide them. So the age limit of for the communist youth was raised from 23, considerably more than that, I think it became. I'm not sure exactly what it became, but simply because the transfer of the youth into the adult party had been made much more difficult. And the reasons, well, as he said, he says both measures, obviously contradicting each other, derive nevertheless from the same source, the bureaucracy's fear of the younger generation. And that fear lay at the heart of the fear that lay at the heart of this practice was laid bare also in what Trotsky says. He says, the speakers at the Congress, who according to their own statements were carrying out the express instructions of Stalin, they gave these warnings in order to forestall in advance the very possibility of a debate explained the aim of the reform with astonishing frankness. We have no need of any second party. This argument reveals the fact that, in the opinion of the ruling circles of the Communist Youth League, if it's not decisively strangled, threatens to become a second party. And of course, the Thermidorian regime had already strangled the adult party, and the apparatus wondered aloud. And it said, in his time, no other than Trotsky himself attempted to make a demagogic play for the youth to inspire it with the anti-Leninist, anti-Bolshevik idea of creating a second party, etc., etc. And he comments on this. He says, in reality, Trotsky, in his time, only gave warning that a further bureaucratism of the regime would inevitably lead to the break with the youth and produce the danger of a second party. But at that point, he then carries on. He says, it's no longer a question of the danger, but the historic necessity as the sole power capable of further advancing the cause of the October Revolution. The change in the constitution of the Communist Youth League, though reinforced with fresh police threats, will not, of course, halt the political maturing of the youth and will not prevent their hostile clash with the bureaucracy. And I mean, really, this was by way of a general analysis of the tendencies of the situation, not a detailed prediction, which obviously will be a matter of the struggle of forces. So he says again, this is, well, which way will the youth turn in case of a great political disturbance? Under what banner will they assemble their ranks? Nobody can give a sure answer to that question now, least of all the youth themselves. Contradictory tendencies are furrowing their minds. In the last analysis, the alignment of the principal mass will be determined by historic events of world significance, by a war, by new successes of fascism, or, on the contrary, by the victory of the proletarian revolution in the West. In any case, the bureaucracy will find out that these youth, deprived of rights, represent a historic charge with a mighty explosive power. But as he pointed out, the Thermidorian regime's arrogance spoke against it. He notes that in 1894, the Russian autocracy, through the lips of the young Tsar Nicholas II, answered the zemstvos, which were sort of like local elected council bodies, I believe, which were timidly dreaming of participating in political life, with the famous words, meaningless fancies. In 1936, the bureaucracy answered the as yet vague claims of the younger generation with the still ruder cry, stop your chatter. These words will too become historic. The regime of Stalin may pay no less dearly for them than the regime headed by Nicholas II. And I'll leave it there. That's my presentation for today. And we'll open it up to discussion if that's okay with comrades. Yeah. Cheers.
Can I just say something? Sorry. When did we discuss the women? You mentioned that earlier. I don't remember that. Did I miss something?
3 weeks ago, I think you probably did. Yes, I think you were not around. It was all.
Oh, that's a sh—
Yeah,
Oh, well.
it is actually on the website. You can listen to the discussion if you
Oh,
go.
yeah, of course.
You go onto the website, the podcast is there, and the whole discussion is actually available to be listened to if you want.
Thank you.
Sure. Anybody want to speak on this?
Okay, I want to speak then.
Yeah, sure, Marie.
Nobody wants to go before me. What about you, Paul? He's not there.
He's not like that.
I bloody am. I'll probably come in after you, but it's not directly related to text.
Sure.
About Mark. Yeah. Mark wants to speak.
Who wants to speak?
Yeah, I was just wondering. Obviously, there's no parallel to a revolutionary communist party that is active and influential today. But is there any lessons that can be learnt in terms of how to treat, with respect and some empathy, an uprising in useful political fervour, such as we see today?
Well, I think we have to, don't we? We have to find a way to address them, to address that part of the political life, I suppose you could say. And yes, we do. We have to. I mean, I went on the demonstration yesterday and sold a lot of literature to a lot of different kinds of people. Some of whom were very young, you know. Some of whom were not, you know. But we do have to find ways. I mean, obviously, we have limited resources, but we do have to find ways of targeting those resources and winning over some younger people, I think. I think that's essential. That's my view. It's a difficult tactical question because we're all a bit up. We're all a little bit long in the tooth, including myself. Yeah. And it's got to be done, though. Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree.
But we're still the ideas people at the moment. Yeah, no,
absolutely. But we have to bring others into this. Yeah.
Yeah.
Marie, sorry, I'll let Marie speak.
I think when we follow up this from the introduction, we have to look again at the text a little bit, and then we can comment on how it influences. Why is it relevant today? I think it's important to give a little bit more importance because it was a period of incredible repression in the Soviet Union. It's easy to forget because Trotsky doesn't complain personally. It's easy to forget the actual violence, physical, political, economic even, violence of the bureaucracy. I saw somewhere on Wikipedia, it said, to eradicate those deemed enemies of the working class, Stalin instituted the Great Purge, in which over 1 million were imprisoned, largely in the Gulag system of forced labor camps, and at least 700,000 executed between 1934, this was written in 36, 1934 and 39. By 1937, which is going to be only in a few months from this book, he had absolute control over the party and the government. So it is not like Trotsky complains or he doesn't even speak about his own plight. He never actually presents himself as with a full force of what's happening to him. He thinks of the country, he thinks of the world, and he thinks of the working class, which is very very edifying, really. I think that it's interesting that he says the core of the suppression and the repression was in the party. This is where the youth had gone as part of the elevation of society towards greater forms of democracy. Now, at every contact with politics, the youth, the young people, burn their fingers. If you touch anything political, you are going to be in the crosshairs. The youth have the option three options then. You make a career in the bureaucracy, if you can, because this is only for a few. You fall silent and perhaps eat or go back into domestic life or something. Or to you join the underground and learn how to temper your character for the future. And quite a few did this. This is why Trotsky could build the Fourth International, because this continued, the decision, the determination not to be crushed continued, and not least of all in Russia, in the Soviet Union. So this middle group, which is the majority, which seems to fall silent, it cannot be said to be coward. Inside of it, there is all sorts of trends, and there is hidden processes there, which will come to light in future events. And Trotsky tried to project the future events. Yeah. This is why Stalin hated him, because he could actually use logics to actually see where the process was going. And the bureaucracy accused him about this thing of a second party, which is a complete farce, the thing that Ian explained. He had never posed the need for a second party. The thing is so falsely reversed and falsified that you can see what sort of bandits there were in that leading bureaucracy. And so with this way of thinking of theirs, they could not see that the bureaucracy was separating itself from the youth, because they were denying it all. They were denying what Trotsky was saying, so they couldn't even see where they, as a bureaucracy, were going. I thought it was important, this little aspect on asceticism. So you are correct me, eh? As everybody understands.
Asceticism.
Right. So as far as I understood this, it meant the attitude of those who wanted to get into the bureaucracy and to get to the privileges, to try to get to the places where there was relative prosperity. For these people, they were sort of using their elbows and trying to you had to be greedy and actually get on and further yourself. This is me sort of paraphrasing. But it was all based, in any case, it was based on not very edifying notions, the greed for profit, which was denounced at the Congress of the Communist Youth. It's interesting that Congress of the Communist Youth, because that was probably one of the last times when people would get together to actually discuss, even if they were shut up. That was in April 1936. And the communist young, they said, we are against the greed for profit, pettiness, and base egotism, which is very lovely, because this is the way of the youth. This was not in line with the party line, which was saying it's okay to have a handsome and prosperous life. If you work hard, which was with peace work, you get a premium and a decoration, and you're advancing yourself. And this is definitely something to be lauded. The party claims to be socialist and socialism, is not aesthetic, like those who live by asceticism in Christianity. That, I think that was the dig at those, you know, who say that you should just wait until you are dead to have to go to paradise. Socialism adheres to this world, and it doesn't promise a good life after death. This is me paraphrasing. So the mood of the time, as impelled by the bureaucracy, was we want success now, and it's going to be measured by the number of trousers and the number of neckties coming from the line. This historic state of difficulty and scarcity, this is me paraphrasing, is unavoidable. And I think Trotsky says that, you know, he says that nobody thinks of blaming the Soviet Union for counting the trousers and the neckties. But it is necessary to qualify that stage and not pretend that it measures success in socialism. And the young do not opt for engineering professions because they want socialism. Perhaps they do as well, but it is because it's better paid. And all this is glossed over by the bureaucracy, which its idealism of advancing yourself and having a prosperous life, which is abysmal. And so Trotsky says, when you present this intellectual oppression as socialist culture, you enable petty egotism, self-advancement, and therefore contempt for what is in the common interest. And that gets overridden by the falsehood, which is presented as something to be wished. This breeds antisocial behavior. So I think this links up with what Ian was saying about terrorism. We should not forget to return to these matters because they are constantly and forever topical. Why terrorism? Why antisocial behavior? The bureaucracy could only deal with it with repression, saying people are bad and that's full stop. But it is not like this. The youth, particularly the youth, they are magnanimous. They are enterprising and they are responsive. They are not like the bureaucracy would like them to be. Careerism, Trotsky says, colors them from above. But deep down, the youth is motivated by sentiments and tendencies grounded in heroism. And you know, I believe this. but those in charge, they repress and suppress this with the Soviet patriotism. So I think this is another aspect, because now there is patriotism in a grand scale, in a big way, in Russia, and I would like to go back one day to this concept. Mm-hmm. So here Trotsky says, it's a deep, deep, sincere and dynamic sentiment, but undermined by the social structure that separates the young from the old. So I think it's very beautiful. Well, so, I would like to bring this to a close to say, well done giving importance to this, Ian. This is full of very important conclusions. I would like later on to go back to the question of the youth and to Corbyn, who represented the youth, really, and what's happened to us. Yes, thank you.
Sure. Okay, Mark. Mark wants to speak.
Well, that's a difficult one to follow, and it sounds ridiculous what I'm going to say, but in relation to what Marie just said about Corbyn, he managed to engage the youth, and I think we struggle to actually do it. I find the youth of today very polite and empathetic and very open, and I think the fact that we still struggle to engage them is a massive problem. In fact, I feel that we struggle to engage a lot of people, and there's something somewhere that's stopping the left getting through. I know we have a powerful media and powerful government pushing it across, but there's something stopping us, and we still haven't learned a lesson, and I don't know where it is. I can't answer that. But anyway, if we can't engage the youth, we might as well forget it.
Well, I agree. Bye, Ian. Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I think we have to find a way to do this. And it might take time, it might be difficult, but it has to be done. And I think that's what we have to adapt our ways of organising to try and attract people, to sort of try and engage people who are a lot younger than we are. And I think that's absolutely crucial. I'm thinking of ways of looking. We probably have to discuss ways of doing this. But I think it is essential. Who else wants to speak? I think Paul said he wanted to speak at some point, didn't he?
It was connected with what Murray was about to say, but since he mentioned Corbyn, please go, maybe go next, and if I've got anything else to say, then I'll take it.
Okay. You want to speak again, Murray, or what?
I would like to ask you questions, Ian.
Yes, sir.
I found things which I did not understand. I'm just looking them up now. It was not that Engels and Lenin were wrong to think that the new generation would cast out statism, democratic republican stateism. Do you see what I mean?
I understand what you mean. What they're talking about is a different perspective, isn't it? Like they were talking about not the generation of the Russian Revolution, but of the propensity of youth to push forward to the communism and the abolition of the state as a repressive organization, including, as Lenin pointed out, the so-called Republican Democratic State. But as he pointed out, bourgeois democracy is a phony, and it actually is the, there's a famous quote from Lenin, it says, the more highly developed a democracy is, the more imminent are pogroms and martial law in connection with any profound political disturbance which the bourgeoisie considers to be dangerous to itself, or something along those lines. That's what Lenin was talking about the fake nature of capitalist democracy and what and how it handles profound political divergences and threats, not in a democratic way at all. You know, that's what Lenin was talking about. That's what Mengels was talking much more in the past about the future of socialism and how the youth would be the driving force for, after the revolution, for the deepening of it and the drive towards communism and the abolition of statism altogether. Lenin was just adding a bit more to that, really, I think. You know, that's how I interpret those quotes anyway. I think they're very useful. Yeah.
Ian, I have another question. Can I ask it?
Yeah, of course.
So where Trotsky talks about, the oppression in the Congress, where you should not talk about politics, this is not for you. So you have to, this leads to have to give personal loyalty to the people on the top. Mm-hmm. You have to give personal loyalty to the people in charge. And it becomes a great leader, we are told it is in North Korea. I don't know if it's true in North Korea, but that is very much said about North Korea. Hence, says Trotsky, unconditional obedience to the leader. And then he goes on, aphorisms and maxims resemble those of Goebbels.
Goebbels, yes.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I think he was just using, he pointed out that the some of the antics of the Stalinist regime were actually copied from the Nazis and vice versa, actually. They copied each other in terms of, techniques they used to shut people up, basically, or to slander people and render them helpless in the face of political condemnation and isolation, and ultimately, of course, they put them in camps. Not quite in the same way, but nevertheless, if you were considered to be dangerous, in even remotely dangerous in Stalin's Russia, they sent you to a camp, didn't they? That's what he's talking about, I think.
Thank you.
I think Paul wanted to speak. Yeah.
Joseph Goebbels, wasn't he Hitler's minister for propaganda?
Was it there?
Yeah. Okay. There were two, wasn't there? There were Goebbels and someone, was it Goering?
Goering was the man in charge of the military, particularly the Air Force, I believe. But yeah.
He was the newspaper, wasn't there? What was his name?
The newspaper was run by, I can't remember off the top of my head. Was it Heydrich? It wasn't Heydrich.
Yeah, no, it wasn't Heydrich. It'll come in a minute, but he was a nasty piece of work than the rest of them.
Himmler was the leader of the SS, wasn't he? Himmler. I can never remember who was who exactly.
But he got a short name. Yeah. He wrote the newspaper and he joined in with the propaganda thing.
Mm. But Goebbels was the head of propaganda anyway. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
In charge of the newspaper, which was Der Stürmer. Der Stürmer.
Der Stürmer.
Yeah, Der Stürmer. Which is appropriate in some ways. Yeah. Marie, yeah.
There's nobody put their hand up. I would like to go back to the question of Trotsky says it's not a problem of two generations. It's not like he's talking about the old and the young. It's not that. The depth of the analysis is not there. It's only that in any major conflict, new recruits would bring their forces to the side of the oppressed. So he sees the history in movement, not just a series of pictures. And he sees that the bureaucracy admirably understands everything that threatens its interests. This is why it throws people out of the party and it clears up the party, building trenches and fortifications against those who tomorrow are likely to rise against this horrible situation, which I think is that's where Trotsky, this is where dialectics is different from mechanics. He shows things in movement and in what way things are likely to go in order to foresee. And then he sees that the bureaucracy itself understood this much, even though he understood very little else, was threatening their interests.
Well, just to say that the editor of the Sturmer was actually Julius Streicher.
That's it.
That's the one.
Streicher.
Is
this yeah.
How do you spell it?
Streicher. Streicher. He was actually executed at Nuremberg for some terrible things, actually. He was a child abuser as well as all the other things that they all were.
Yeah, along with Martin Bormann, I think he was the most hated member of the Nazi Party for being really objectional, which is like, this sounds ridiculous to me. It must have been bad.
What's a nice Nazi then?
Exactly.
I don't know, maybe there are a few. A few in the Nazi Party, you know, to keep out of trouble, perhaps. But
I think this is the problem we have with Stalin, is that basically people think that that's communism, and they use that as an argument that is communism. And oh, I know what you're going to say. You're going to say it's nothing to do with communism. Well, it isn't really. He was a counter-revolutionary. So what else am I going to say, you know? And then you get the Randians arguing that Britain is a socialist state rapidly charging towards communism. And I'll do, oh, my God.
I didn't even
oh, dear.
They are lunatics, you know. I had a very good argument yesterday with a Hungarian woman who was quote, she was very pro-Palestinian, but very anti-Russian and anti-Soviet. And she basically said, I grew up in a communist dictatorship and it was terrible. It was Hungary. And I started quoting her stuff from 1956 because I know quite a bit about this. I know about the Central Workers' Council of Greater Budapest and the fact that they effectively created a Soviet. And that Palmalata made public speeches defending socialism and said, we want real socialism and stuff like that. And she just ridiculed that. She said, nah, you can believe that if you like. It's nonsense, you know. But it is historical. Mm-hmm. Just ignore that because of their gut instincts and the way that their family brought them up or whatever, you know. And she was born to parents who were probably quite, well, hostile to the Stalinist regime, hostile to the Communist Party, I suppose. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Or in some ways were alienated from it anyway, you know. I mean, he alienated a hell of a lot of people. There's no doubt about that. That Hungarian regime of Rákosi was pretty appalling, actually. As for North Korea, I'm not sure. I think North Korea is quite bad in terms of the way Stalinist regimes have been, but I don't know how bad, really, now, you know. On the other hand, we do have to defend it because there's only two workers' states left in the world, in my opinion. And one of them is North Korea, the other is Cuba, you know. They're the two surviving elements of the old Soviet bloc that have not been overthrown, you know, or not been fundamentally changed. I think China has fundamentally changed from what it was under Mao. And it's a market-driven sort of hybrid plan. There's a strong element of economic planning, but it's planning a capitalist market of a kind, you know. But North Korea certainly is not that. You know, it's a bureaucratically planned economy, as I see it, with probably a certain limited amount of marketization in it now, but not very much. There's more marketization in Cuba, but even so, it's still not got to the point of a qualitative change, I don't think. Not yet, anyway. You know, hopefully, well, I mean, it will eventually. That's the point. It will eventually, because that is the nature of Stalinist regimes. But Cuba has its own dynamics, and it's probably not going to do that in the way you'd expect, because it was not simply an extension of the Soviet Union. It wasn't. In some ways, Kim Il-sung's regime was. It had some big input from the USSR in its creation, you know. But Cuba didn't really. Cuba actually, the native Communist Party in Cuba was hostile to the Cuban Revolution at the beginning, and then it was later assimilated into it, you know, when Castro made his agreements with the Soviet Union. It was basically told to merge with the Castroite movement, the July 26th movement, that became the Communist Party of Cuba. You know, so I think it's different, you know, but I think North Korea is, I think it's quite a harsh Stalinist regime. But it still has to defend it, you know, against imperialism, against counter-revolution, you know. That's my view, anyway. That's my suspicion. Although I've never been there, that's the thing. I know a man who has. He's just got back, but he's a hardened Stalinist. And that's Dermot, you know. But anyway, Mark wants to speak again, sorry. And Rafik Marie wants to say something afterwards. Mark.
I'll probably be quite brief. I get the feeling from talking to friends of North Korea on Facebook that a lot of the people like their leader, and they like the fact that their leader goes round to talk to them and goes round to the factories and stuff to talk to them. And when you look at North Korea, when it's photographed, generally the negative programs about it to people with American accents, it's quite well built up. And when you think during the Korean War, the Americans flattened both South and North Korea, I think that's pretty good going. But as you say, it's difficult to know just what the regime is all about. But the impression I get from people that know it and have talked to people, it's okay, which is kind of the impression I got in China as well. People thought it was okay, and that was their style, and they don't understand our style of democracy, if you can call it that. So it's kind of, you know, it's difficult, really. It's a complex subject, and people can't simplify it by saying it doesn't work, because basically, can you name a capitalist country that's worked? There isn't one, is there? There's poverty everywhere in capitalist countries. There isn't one that's worked. So basically, that's all I want to say.
Sure. Marie wants to come in, yeah?
Yeah, there was... well said, Mark. There was another... It was the Mensheviks. There's a mention of the Mensheviks who supported the skilled workers, something that you mentioned, Diane. They supported the skilled workers.
Oh, yeah.
And I think if we want now to draw conclusions for this country, I look at the Corbyn movement was not really very specifically in support or defense of labor or social democracy. It was still very reformist. They were still defending NATO and defending Trident, and so it was not even a very revolutionary program. But the movement which was attracted was of young workers massively. In my own area where I am in Camden, there was a meeting, a local meeting by Corbyn during an electoral campaign, and people were queuing, young people, young couples. There was people like me among them, but the mass was young, and they were in the streets and going for miles down the streets in order to get in a former cinema which had been transformed. We filled that whole place. I don't know how many people who must have been there, but it was absolutely enormous. And it was all young people. And then I noticed Corbyn did this in Scotland and everywhere. And my friends in France were calling me to say, you've got this new leader and he's got tremendous support and all the young people are behind. So what we have seen here is the movement of the young people. I don't think they were behind Labour as a solution, but they were behind getting out of capitalism, getting out of the terrible situation, like Mark was saying just now, where people, in fact, are suffering even of hunger. And rickets, there's rickets in the schools in Britain, and people who are actually hungry. And the United States is worse. And just to cut that long bit shorter, what I wanted to say is I have seen in the left which was expelled by this anti-Semitism campaign. So there were people in the Labour Party who were more conscious, they were expelled. And amongst them, a differentiation took place with a layer which was looking forward to a republic, a democratic republic. And then they would be like Tony Greenstein, they would be insisting it should be a socialist republic. And they would find themselves in clashes, in confrontation with people who talked about a social democratic republic. And so we have Mensheviks have developed in that movement around Corbynism, around the Labour left. And I would be so glad if we gave more attention to what's happening there and what we think is developing now, how what we should be saying, because we are, each of us is involved with publications. We should be saying things to give advice and to give support to the sectors of the youth that want to go forward. Yeah.
Paul.
Yeah, on that one, following on from my point really about the youth. I remember seeing those videos and photographs from the time. It was a very exciting moment, and as a former Labour Party member myself, that was my, when Corbyn was the leader of the Labour Party, yes, he was a bourgeoisie politician in the way that we understand it, but nevertheless, the Overton window slightly shifted during that particular period. And elements of the bureaucracy within the Labour Party really didn't like that. And following on from that, the tragedy of that whole period. Well, the good thing is that many of those people that were involved in the Labour Party, specifically during the Corbyn period, they haven't gone away. No. But there's a material problem, isn't there? And that is, we and they we're all in different organisations and different parties. I'm in Cranford form, although I'm too old to be youth, but compared to some of you lot here,
you are, Paul.
Exactly. For those that don't know, Cranform was a mix of an organisation called Left Unity, which was originally formed by Ken Loach, but then many of his lot joined the Labour Party when Corbyn became leader. So, and then, but after Corbyn came a party called Breakthrough. Mm-hmm. Now, Breakthrough was different in the sense that it wasn't an exclusively youth party, but it was certainly pitching towards the Corbynist youth, as it were, and the main key officer positions were from the youth, people up to the age of 26, that sort of thing. And then, so Left Unity broke through, and one or two others got together and formed Transform. I like some of the things that are currently happening within that organisation. The problem I have today is that while it may turn out to have a very good programme on a domestic level, and could really come out with some policies that could really transform people's lives, it does have a poor foreign policy position. They do tend to take an anti-Russian, anti-Chinese viewpoint, despite what they say about America and NATO and so on. So to sum up, really, the youth of the Corbyn period haven't gone away, but the problem is we've all dissipated into different, split into different organisations, and somehow we need to find a way of trying to unite under one banner and really forcing the issue against the main bourgeoisie parties. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Yeah. Who else wants to speak? I'm going to come in on that if you like. Does anybody else want to speak first? Seeing none, shall I just make a point about the fragmentation of left and parties, etc.? If you read the second part of the LCFI programme, it addresses that in some detail about the fragmentation and the multiple fragmentation of the Trotskyist movement and why that happened, you know. But I think there needs to be a program of regroupment of people who don't necessarily have to agree on everything, but have to agree on certain broad, broad positions on crucial conflicts like Ukraine and Zionism and whatever, but not necessarily have to agree on everything, you know, on theoretical things. I think that has to be brought about as a regroupment of the left. But I think there has to be polarisation as well. This is the far, you know, the revolutionary left, the people who claim to be revolutionaries. I think that has to happen. But I also agree that there has to be something that pushes forward onto a more broad level of the class party, you know. And I think that's what we're trying to do in the SLN, among other things, you know. Trying to use that as a think tank to try and promote the idea of unity in action. Freedom of criticism, unity in action, was the watchword of the Bolshevik, of the Russian Social Democratic Party in its process of formation, you know. And I think we need something like that here, a precursor to a more radical working class party that can develop towards communism, you know. And I think that's something we have to advocate. We're not in favour of purges and heresy hunts and whatever. On the as long as people agree with certain basic principles, you know, I think there should be a lot of room for debate in a part. Obviously, people who are on the other side of the barricades, we're not going to unite with, you know, on key questions of the day. I'm not going to invite people who support Zionism or support Ukrainian fascism or whatever and claim to be on the left, because such people do exist, and I think they are pretty odious, and they're a long way from us politically, and a long way from most of the ex-Corbyn left politically, and a long way from a lot of the people on the Palestine solidarity demonstrations. I think there's a lot of instinctive agreement, even though it might not be that conscious, about who the enemy is, you know, and there's a lot of confusion about what the enemy is in detail, but there is a lot of understanding as well, basic understanding of the broad contours of these questions. And I think the positive response that we get when we raise placards that link Israel and Zionism with the defence of the Donbass and what's going on in Ukraine, I think is an indication of that. We do get friendly coverage and friendly responses from all sorts of people when we raise that on the big Palestine demos. And it's something we need to find ways of doing more with as well, which is actually bringing more consciousness of, we've been trying to do this for a long time. I think we are having a certain impact. Bring more consciousness of the link between these struggles, you know, and the fact that imperialism is waging a war against the Palestinians, and it's also waging the war against the people of the Donbass. And it may well be waging a war at some point against the people of China over, you know, over Taiwan or something, you know, or who knows where else, you know. So there are, you know, this is all, it's all linked, and it all poses the question of where we're going as a planet in some ways, you know, because it poses the questions of World War III and things like this, you know. But all these things are linked. But yeah, we do have to approach, we do have to find ways of bringing that to the youth and actually engaging with young people as well. Which is really the subject matter of this discussion in a sort of a bleak way, because we were talking about the historical aspects of the USSR and Stalinism, but nevertheless, it's all relevant. Yeah. I'll leave it there for that. Mark wants to speak again.
Yeah, I was just going to say, well, I think we've got too many left-wing parties. They're all very good, but I don't understand why they're so fractious. It's like... and then somebody says, oh, we need a brand new left party. And then somebody comes up with a left diggity doodah party or something. And we're all off in that direction. And it's no different to the other ones. Well, I mean, whatever happened to Left Unity, I think, was going to be the biggest party. And I don't understand why the left can't stand together. I mean, the Tories manage it. They've even got UKIP in with them now. So if those idiots can manage it, why can't we? I just don't get it.
Oh, good point.
that's all I'm going to say.
Yeah. Well, it's got to be done. It's got to be. We've got to be able to build it's got to be a communist. You know, it's got to be able to develop towards communist politics. Otherwise, it will be just another Labour Party. That's the problem. You know, we don't want to create another Labour Party with another bureaucracy that could turn out to be counter-revolutionary like the old Labour Party bureaucracy. So we have to guard against that. We also have to guard against sectarian, sorts of projects that are far too narrow. We have to try and find a way between those two problems, I think. You know, Susan, sorry.
I was going to say, with respect, the gap between UKIP and Tory, and the gap between Tory, UKIP and National Front, when it comes to common values, they really already share such a lot in common. It's not really surprising that they don't end up rowing with each other. I think the real problem that the left has is they don't focus enough on what I would call the fundamentals, like equality and social justice. They're too busy trying to establish a hierarchy of which order they're going to do it in, instead of actually facing up to the simple question of what is happening, is it fair, is it just, and will it lead us to a better adjusted society? And if it isn't, that's what we should be fighting, and this is what we have to fight together. I would say, as far as attracting the young people goes, the biggest thing for me is there is too much old guard telling people how to do things and not enough telling young people, communicating what do you want the future to look like, and tell us, we will share together how we think it can be achieved. But there's no the biggest thing that all the people who have started to become independent is that they have to listen. And what's wrong with all the parties is that once they're established is they want to tell you what they're going to do. They do not sit there and say, what do you want done? And how can we work together to achieve it? And if we want the left to appeal to young people, that is what we're going to have to do. It's to learn to listen. And that was the huge gift that Corbyn had. He'd spent 40 years in the community and listening to people and listening to their problems and finding out from other people and those people how they'd solved their problems. You know, and he's done that on a massive scale. I don't think most people realize it, you know, how hard that man works all the time and has done for the last sort of, you know, 45 years nationally and internationally. And we have a quite despicable, privileged elite who sit on their hands, take credit for everything and do nothing for us. And we have been mugged by a populist media into believing that that's how, you know, important people should behave, that they're always too busy to listen to you because they're far too busy solving other people's problems, when in reality, they're just lining their pockets. Anyway, that's me.
Anybody else? Yeah, Marie.
Maybe we should also... Oh, go on.
So let Mark speak first, then Marie.
Oh, thank you. Just a quick one. We should also highlight to that generation the importance of infrastructure spending. More genuine social housing. Highlighting the fact that it's taken 14 fucking years for the Tories to give lip service to a new pothole-filling programme of our main artery roads, for example. And that redistribution of wealth has, in favour of the majority of people, is something which is an absolute priority. And with us being sold out completely now to Zionism, and as you say, rightly say, Susan, that politicians and the establishment and the elite have taken their eyes, both of their eyes, off popular opinion, that's the opportunity that we have before us to advertise these meat and potato issues to the younger people, you know?
Can I just say one other thing? I mean, I think what you just said is interesting, but I think redistribution of wealth is fine, but it doesn't really go far enough. Because, I mean, if you look at the huge problems that we've got, like climate change, the ruination of large sections of the population by the austerity and all the things that have gone with it, in the imperialist countries even, you know, I think redistribution of wealth sounds a bit tame. You know, what we really need to be talking about is expropriation of capitalist monopolies and economic planning to solve all these huge problems. You know, it will take economic planning on an international level to solve the problem of human caused climate change. That is not possible to be solved under capitalism, and it's getting worse. I mean, I don't know how quickly it's going to get worse, but it is visibly getting worse. You know, we are heading for a really hellish future if we don't resolve this, and it's going to be, you know, this is the, you know, the more radical argument as opposed to the mere redistribution and the sort of Labour, you know, left-wing Labour government type argument. We need something more radical than that, because we're going to hell in a handcart if we don't actually resolve problems like that, you know. And it has to be done on a massive scale. There has to be compulsion against people from using against industries or whatever that use fossil fuels. At some point, they have to be, you know, weaned away from that by compulsion. You know, there can't be.
Well, that's why you don't rely. Pardon? Sorry, Ian, but that's why you don't rely upon the decades-long capitalist agenda.
Yeah, exactly.
Of what redistribution actually means. I mean, yes, we do need it, but it needs to be, as you say, far broader.
Yeah.
To cover a multitude of sins now in a way that has never been possible or worth seriously considering before.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Diana wants to speak. Sorry.
You mentioned expropriation. Then there's the thing about redistribution of wealth and stuff. Well, what's wealth and what do you do with it? The real problem is that capital has expropriated the earth's resources that we depend on. And you might have more money, but if you haven't got what you need to sustain a nice healthy life, money's sodding useless. I'm not feeling very coherent, sorry, but infrastructure, that's an important one, and housing. What we have is a housing policy where if you're lucky enough to actually be housed, you still can't get to work without travelling for hours quite often in a car belching exhaust, which is killing yourself, well, harming your own health and everyone else's. These aren't separate issues. They're all the same linked issue, that everything is being done for making profit for the people who are stealing the resources from us and depriving everyone, whether they've got, well, mostly people who haven't got money, but even when people do have money, the resources we need for a healthy life are stolen from us. And people don't have, people are lied to by the media. They believe the rubbish that we're, you know, the government's dietary guidelines are controlled by the food industry, which tells them what's good for us. Actually, what we're told is actually very harmful for us, and actually leaving people with serious health problems. Those health problems are getting worse. And when we've got that Sunak bastard saying, oh, we can't possibly be having more sick people. Well, of course we're getting more sick people. People haven't got the means to keep healthy. They're eating rubbish, being lied to that rubbish is food, or it's called junk food. No, it's not junk food. It's the junk substitute for food. And that's all that's available to people. And then people don't have clean air to breathe. And then, if they're working what might seem a reasonable number of hours a day for work, they still got to spend 2 or 3 hours a day travelling. I mean, I don't know how to sort of be coherent, sorry.
Right. Oh.
Brilliant. You're fine.
Oh.
Yeah, Mark and Ian were both right, actually, in the sense that what suddenly occurred to me was Mark talked about redistribution of wealth, but he went further by mentioning infrastructure. And I thought that was a key point, because when you speak to people on, you know, if you speak to a stranger on the street or whatever, or you know, or even if it's someone you know. The chances are, if you talk about redistribution of wealth, they think of money, as in, I pay more taxes, and that will get redistributed that way. But as Gary Stevenson explained in one of the YouTube videos, that's not really wealth. The wealth is infrastructure, buildings, and that sort of thing. Organisations that actually run these things. And so I thought Mark raised an interesting point, because that's the ultimate wealth. It's land, buildings, transport systems, etc. And that's the real distribution of wealth. So the key point is, it's the old adage, isn't it? You can't control what that you do not own, which is why you need to renationalise the land, transport, etc. And it needs to be a big part of the overarching political programme. Thanks.
Sure. Anybody else want to speak on any of this? Because the only person who hasn't spoken is John, I think. Everybody else has spoken. But anybody who wants to speak is very welcome. You know?
I just put a message up, basically, about Millicent in Liverpool. They got a big pot of money off the Tories under the promise that they'd make people redundant, and they didn't. They pretended. And then they proceeded to build housing and leisure centres and change the face of Liverpool, which was about to be shut down by the Tories. I wonder why they managed to be so popular, and how they managed that, and how much were they related to the left?
Well, can I just come back on that? That does actually ring a bell, because that happened during the miners' strike, didn't it? That big pot of that big pot of money was made available for them. It's obvious why, because they wanted to stop Liverpool blowing up during the miners' strike, which would open the second front against Thatcher. So Thatcher basically gave them a lot of concessions during the strike and helped thereby to isolate the miners more. And then after the strike was defeated, then, of course, the bourgeoisie came back at the militants and destroyed Liverpool Council. It was Kinnock. He played a major role in that witch hunt, you know. But they actually damaged themselves enormously by going along with that and not trying to mobilise people, you know, explicitly for their struggles in solidarity with, you know, in unison, not merely in solidarity, but in unison with the miners. And I think that was a real problem at Liverpool. Liverpool was, yeah, there were obviously major gains developed in Liverpool and the militant, but they were, their reformism, their problem is that they are actually left reformist. And if they see, if they can get something through the system, they'll say, oh, great, wonderful, you know. But it was rather short-sighted, because they didn't actually understand that was effectively a bribe to keep out of the fray while the Tories are taking on the miners. You know, no, they didn't understand that. They fell into the trap, in my opinion. You know, and obviously they should have been able to explain that to their base and say, yes, we got this money, but they'll take it away from us as soon as the miners are defeated. If they had a little bit of foresight and the ability to tell the truth to the masses, as Trotsky said, no matter how bitter it may be, they would have been in a stronger position, you know, I think, and they could have actually delivered a lot of their mass base to actually, you know, physically support the miners in that period, because that was a strategic defeat for the British working class, and it still affects us today, you know. Marie, sorry.
No.
You are muted, Marie.
Is it okay if I continue, or did you want to close now?
Oh, no, you continue for a bit. I mean, let's continue. Let's carry on for about 10 more minutes, and then we'll go on to other things. Yeah, is that all right?
Yeah. Mark has put, if we could get him to start another party. I think there's a point there, because he could have tried. Had he tried that, he would have had a tremendous support. And but I think he was scared of that. He did not do it, not because he so much than because he could not, but because he was afraid that it was going to go beyond what he himself feels capable of doing. I think this is why he doesn't do it. He had many opportunities to create a Labour left, and he doesn't do it. And it's the case with all of these Labour leaders. They were parliamentarians. They were not radical organisers. They were parliamentarians. And so their vision is that they are going to do things for the workers instead of the workers. Oh, the workers should not be doing it for themselves. Oh, hell will break loose when the workers start doing it for themselves. They see it as loss of control if the workers start organizing society, organizing their party. They are all scared of this. And I think that's where we are. I wanted to say that because with the SLN, I think that's probably where we have a chance to explain this, mm-hmm. that the new party, you know, they want to help create a new party, and I think there's a lot of organisation wanting this. But if that new party is just a repeat, like somebody has said here, a repeat of Labour, that just won't have even a start of success, because what's needed is something which is now going to enable that mass which supported Corbyn, which is the working class and the youth, to allow them to actually develop organizations like this assembly I was telling you in Camden should have ended up with a permanent committee of the area, of the whole constituency. And that was the last thing Corbyn would be convinced of, because he was scared of this. This is why he went right, left and centre, rousing enough people to get votes, but not to get people to do things for themselves. And I think that's where we are. Yeah.
Sure.
That's what I wanted to say.
Anybody else want to speak?
I've got to go now, work. So okay. See you guys. See you next time.
Why don't we wind this up on to other business? I'll close the recording down, yeah? And we can go on to other business. Is that okay with comrades, yeah?
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. I'll stop the recording.